This time, he'll do the spinning. Today on Uncommon Knowledge, a leading entertainer who is also a normal human being and an unapologetic conservative, Wheel of Fortune's Pat Sajak. From Beverly Hills, Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A native of Chicago, Pat Sajak got his start in show business as a teenaged disc jockey. In 1981, Mr. Sajak began hosting Wheel of Fortune. As of last week's statistics, that is more than three decades after he began hosting the show, Wheel of Fortune remained in the top three syndicated programs in all of television and was viewed by an average of 9 million Americans a day. One of the most popular entertainers in the history of television, Mr. Sajak is also remarkable for a second reason. In a town so heavily Democratic that Barack Obama has so far raised more than five times as much Hollywood money as Mitt Romney, Mr. Sajak represents an unapologetic conservative. Pat Sajak, welcome.
I'll accept unapologetic conservative. Normal, I'm not sure I'm ready to accept that.
I intend to establish that. Right. I've talked to friends who say that this is one of your leading characteristics.
How are you, Peter?
I'm well. Good. I'm well. First things first, does Vanna White get to keep all those clothes she wears?
It is. You know, it's funny when I'm with her and someone comes up to her, or we're in the studio and someone has a question from the audience, that's question one. And then question two is, are you sure you get to keep, not don't get to keep it? I mean, there's not, that's pretty much the focus. And the answer is no, she doesn't. I get to keep her clothes. It's a very unusual arrangement.
All right. Segment one, learning about America. When I mentioned on Ricochet that I'd be interviewing you, one member put up a post saying, and I thought it was really quite striking, quote, "My impression is that Pat Sajak is from a part of the country," close quote. In other words, you don't seem like a media creation. You seem like an American who bears the imprint of the time and place where he grew up. Chicago in the 50s and 60s. What kind of family? What did your dad do? Tell us about it.
Yeah, I suppose, there's certainly no show business in my blood at all, and yet it is something I've always aspired to. I grew up watching Jack Parr on television on The Tonight Show, and he was sort of my idol, and I would sneak out of bed at night, not to go out with the guys or grab a beer, but it was to turn on The Tonight Show and see what Jack was up to. We became good friends later in life, by the way. But so I can't explain exactly where that came from, but yeah, our life was... I don't know how you describe it today. I guess you'd say lower middle class, and we were from an industrial part of the city. I used to come home after school and flip on the TV, because back then all the Cub games were on television. They were day games. And rather than the cartoons, I would turn on the Cubs and when I would come home. And I would see beauty shots of downtown Chicago, and it looked like Oz to me. I thought, there are people with sailboats, and they're rich people live down there. And wow, what are they? Because we were in our little neighborhood, it was a very neighborhood oriented city. We rarely left. Well, I got a little older. I found out we were like 8 minutes from downtown Chicago, but I thought it was the other side of the moon.
Sajak is what kind of name?
It's Polish.
Polish name.
There was a D in my. I think if you were in Warsaw, my name was spelled Sajdak, and I think it would have been pronounced Sajdak if I'm not mistaken. So I grew up with that extra D, and it was pronounced Sajak, and it drove the teachers crazy. But I kept it all my life. When I started in television, I didn't use it on the air, but I kept it. It was on all my credit cards and everything. And I liked the separation. But then when I got married and we had children, I thought, I don't want to put my kids through the same thing I went through. So we dropped it. There's a D out there somewhere that used to belong to me.
So already there's a mystery. Polish background, blue-collar
sure.
neighborhood, Chicago. That should have stamped you as a Democrat for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and we were, I can't say it was a politically active family. We were from Chicago. Of course we were Democrats. I didn't know there were elections. I just thought Mayor Daley had been crowned somewhere along the way, and there he was. And I'm not joking about that. I don't recall elections. They may have happened. I'm sure they did. There's probably some regulation to that effect. But it certainly didn't affect our lives. There's no epiphany here. We were nominally Democratic. My father would gripe about all politicians. You'd read the paper and they're crooks, they're all crooks. And he was probably right in that, especially that group in that city at that time. Maybe even now. But anyway, I remember a moment. I was get, I was probably 18, 17, 18 years old. Didn't care much. I didn't follow politics real closely. Johnson and Goldwater.
Right, 64.
64. I would have been 18. And I sort of figured Johnson was going to win, and Goldwater seemed a little goofy to me, and I didn't. And so an odd thing happened. I picked up the Chicago Sun-Times, and an editorial cartoonist, Herb Block, he went
right,
by.
Right, sure.
The worst editorial cartoonist in the world, by the way, because he labeled everything. If he drew a picture of a glass, he'd write glass on there, and then yes. an arrow pointing to it so you'd understand that was a glass. He would do that with the Soviet Union. There'd be a bear, it would say Soviet Union, there'd be a sickle. He didn't want to make any mistakes. Anyway, Goldwater had made, as I'm sure you remember, a famous remark. He was being painted as this extremist, and his line was, extremism in defense of liberty is no vice.
Right.
Strikes me as a pretty okay thing to say. I pick up the paper, and there's this editorial cartoonist, and it showed two bank robbers, and I know because it said bank robbers with arrows pointing to them, and they were leaving the scene of the crime. They were shooting at the police behind them, and one of them was turning the other, saying, extremism in defense of liberty is no vice. And I thought, that's the first time I remember saying, that's not right. That's not what he was saying. That's not the point he was trying. What are you doing here? And for some reason,
it's just unfair.
Yeah, for some reason, it started to attune me a little bit to that kind of coverage of thing. And that's a strange thing to point to, but it did be. And by the time the campaign was over, I was putting Goldwater stickers on the window for all the good it did us.
All right. Columbia College in Chicago, a professor, teacher of yours says, look, there's a little station over here that's got an opening, and so you start as doing the night shift as a disc jockey, and in 1968, you join the Army and go to Vietnam, and when they discover your background, you become the voice of Armed Forces Radio. And how did you begin the day?
I would yell "Good morning, Vietnam," which very loudly at 6 a.m, which is really silly to do when the enemy is like nearby. You should be quiet, in hushed tones. You should speak. But yeah, I did that for it was. It seems strange to say being in Vietnam, but it was terrific duty. I mean, it was the biggest market I'd ever worked in. We had 500,000 American soldiers, all these civilians there. Most of the Vietnamese wanted to hear American music.
And you were in Saigon.
I was in Saigon.
In Vietnam broadcasting.
I was. Oh yes, indeed. When I first went to Vietnam, they made me a finance clerk and sent me out to some fort about 30 miles outside the city. And I'd made repeated. It really wasn't the Army discovering my background. It was repeated attempts to get transferred, and they finally allowed me to do that. And I did it for about a year and a half. I was the guy, not the guy depicted in the film. That was a guy named Adrian Cronauer, and I was one or two guys removed from him. But that was the format. If you did the morning show, you yelled "Good morning, Vietnam," and now he did it.
And what did you learn about America in Vietnam?
Not a thing. I am
reaching for something profound here. Set it right up.
I know. And strange, because I was obviously very close to what was going on. And the war and the whole thing that was going on is not any more clear to me than anyone else. In fact, in some ways less clear, because the whole anti-war movement back here, I was gone. I didn't see that. And we didn't have satellites and instantaneous television. I mean, I heard the moon landing on radio. Right. And saw pictures the next day, so it was a different era. So I'd hear about these protesters, and it seemed like it was happening in another country. It happened to be my country, but I wasn't there at the time. So I have an odd view of the war. It seemed we were all sort of pulling in the same direction, and it seemed I don't want to say noble, but it seemed the right thing to do to us, because we were either in some cases asked. Told to be there, draftees, or we agreed to go, as
so
I did when I joined.
When you came home, was there another kind of Herb Block Goldwater moment? When you hear the war as it was understood and described by anti-war protesters, there's a little cognitive dissonance in Pat Sajak's mind. You say, no, that wasn't what it was like.
Well, yeah, and I, you know, I have no trouble. Most wars, I think you could sit down and you could have a debate, and you could decide why this was a good thing to get into, it wasn't, what the results were, how we did it, how we executed this or that. My hackles were raised when I got back, and I, you know, I wasn't a combat guy, so I didn't come back and people weren't spitting on me or whatever.
Right.
But I know a lot of guys from that period who are still messed up from the experience, not just the experience itself, but the aftermath. They're only now being taken into the American family, if you will. There was always, I mean, if you recall, for, I must have been 20 years after, if you were from another planet and you came down and watched television and went to the movies, you would think everyone who served in Vietnam came back crazed and was taking hostages, because that was always the villain in these pieces. Now I go to veterans events, and I'm not a real veteran activist, I will say that to you, but on occasion I'll go to them, and guys are still dealing with all that, and they're still coming to terms with it and coming to peace with it. It's been a very difficult road for them.
Huge success with Wheel of Fortune, but let's get you from Vietnam to Wheel of Fortune, because there's a surprising amount of hard work and struggle, really, as I read it. You go, you're demobbed, so to speak, in Washington. You stay in Washington, D.C., take a job as a night clerk at the Madison Hotel, and try to find work. You end up finding work in a small station in southeastern Kentucky. Then you move to the Big Time, which is a small station in Nashville, before coming out here as a weatherman to Los Angeles. So there's some small towns and late hours and hard struggle.
Yeah. You know, I have a real low threshold for celebrity sob stories.
You have no impulse to romanticize this.
No, I don't. Look, I went from place to place. I was trying to find work some places. I didn't some places. You go the path of least resistance sometimes. I do know I was working in this little town in Murray, Kentucky. And I went there because a friend of mine knew a guy who owned the station. I couldn't get work anywhere in D.C., Baltimore, that area. And so I said, I'll go. It was a 250-watt minimum wage kind of thing. And I was there about a year. I was working from 7 to midnight playing rock and roll records. And one night it hit me. I guess I was 25 probably by then. And I said, my career is not really taking off at this moment. So I packed up what little I had and drove to the nearest big city, which was Nashville, where I was enormously successful immediately. I began at a Howard Johnson's and worked there for a good 6 months while I banged on every door. And finally someone got tired of my banging and hired me. So it's no different than anyone else in any other profession. I mean, it's not a tragedy. When I couldn't get a job in broadcasting, I'd work somewhere else. And it didn't seem horrible at the time.
Okay, so here's what I find striking as we sit here in Beverly Hills, this heavily Democratic town, that when you talk about your upbringing in Chicago, and when you talk about Vietnam, and when you talk about this and even give me a little pushback and say, no, I'm not going to romanticize my hard work and my professional struggle. By the time you become the host of Wheel of Fortune, you become, through your life experiences, something of an expert on Middle America. And there's no contempt in you for small towns or for working people in Chicago. You have had 30 years of fame and a big income and living in a nice house here in Los Angeles, and you have not developed any distaste for Middle America at all.
Well, I think you're right, and it's great for me because I can go anywhere and be comfortable. I mean, I have friends of means and high station, and I'm welcome in their midst, and I have a good time, and they're great. But I'm happy to go sit at a fast food place in the Midwest somewhere and talk to people, and I'm comfortable with that. The hardest thing for me to get used to in this whole political thing that's raging around us is this idea of it's the liberal Democrats and the little man and this great bond they have. There's no bond there, and I hate to paint with a broad brush, but I will anyway. There is such disdain for flyover country, and I said I have a lot of you can't work here and not have a lot of liberal friends.
Right,
I mean,
most
of them are, and we don't sit around and talk politics much, but when they do, the disdain drips off their lips. I mean, I was talking to someone about the sort of superior attitude that I detected, and instead of defending it or arguing against it, it was, well, of course we're superior. We travel. We go to other countries where. It was very paternalistic and aggravating to me, and that troubles me the most. This protectorate of the little guy can't stand the little guy.
Right. Segment two: the conservative member of the board of the Claremont Institute, a conservative think tank. member of the board of Eagle Publishing, which owns the conservative newspaper Human Events and the conservative publishing house Regnery, vice chairman of the board of Hillsdale College, the great college in southern Michigan that dedicates itself to instruction in American political philosophy and refuses to accept a penny of federal funding.
Which, by the way, allows them to do things like teach.
That's like really teach. Nice. So you're not just temperamentally conservative. It's not just that you like middle America, whereas some of the liberals in this town feel disdain for middle America. You are actually a committed and well-read and articulate conservative. And I would like to know how that happened. Books, people. Who got you started on the intellectual side of your political thinking?
You know, may I back into that a
little
bit?
Back into it in any way you want.
First of all, I try to be careful with it because I have no trouble with celebrity politics. I mean, this is America, and anyone, even if he's a movie star, can be involved in politics. I object to bait and switch when it comes to celebrities. If I go to see a concert, you know, Shut Up and Sing, as Laura Ingraham, I think, right, titled the book, and you know, don't lecture me about whales. Don't tell me what to do with my recyclables. I'll take care of that. Now, so I try to be political in political situations. When people come to an event where I'm in my political mode, they know what they're getting. Right. So I would never go on Wheel and start proselytizing. I just wouldn't do it. It's not fair to anyone, and it's not why they're paying me. And so I've always tried to maintain a bit of a wall, not because I'm ashamed of my politics, but because I just don't think it's fair to mix them where they don't belong. So, as we like to say now, having said that,
right,
I think, you know, you referred earlier to my struggles as I was trying to get established, and I think that had a bit to do with how you develop in terms of your philosophies and, mm-hmm, and your political philosophies, because there's no reason I should be sitting here. I mean, there's maybe no other country in the world where I would be sitting here doing this, given my beginnings, which were humble with a small H. And I'm proud of that, and I'm not complaining about that, and most people are in that position or even a smaller H. But every now and then it really hits me, without getting corny about it, what a place where I can do this and have had the kind of success I've enjoyed, and things are open to me that I never dreamed could be open to me. I now know where downtown Chicago is. I know where most downtowns are, and I know how to use them. And so, it's more. It really wasn't a. I didn't sit down and I'm reading Ayn Rand, and I didn't. You know, I did. It wasn't.
Right.
It wasn't that. It wasn't an intellectual trail.
Can I press you on that just a little bit more? Not press you, but just talk it through a little bit more. I was always struck that when, this is in the old days when I was a speechwriter in the White House, and quite often staffers in the first few years in the Reagan administration, some staffer or other would say, well, I'm having trouble getting time with the president, but I'll get in the limousine with Ronald Reagan, and we're going from the White House to the hotel where he's delivering a speech, and I'll have 15 minutes to talk about this or that policy or show him this or that briefing paper. And it never worked. Now, why did it never work? Because Ronald Reagan loved to look out the window and wave to people. And it became clear that he liked America. I know that sounds trite or obvious in some way, but I actually think it's quite a profound point that Ronald Reagan wanted the country. He had aspirations for the country. He knew it had faults. He wanted to take it places. But he liked it as it was. And that's what I sense in you as well. Yeah. There's no struggle between Pat Sajak and America. You like the place.
You know, we've done this. What we have accomplished in this little nation of ours in a relatively short time span is just absolutely incredible, and that's why the racial issues that we face, they really trouble me, because look have we had issues over race? And absolutely, do we continue to have them? Absolutely, but I you know, thousands of white people died fighting a civil war, where that was a pretty key part of the whole thing. And I'm not sure that sometimes I worry if that story's been told. We have a friend whose name is Lionel Chetwin, a terrific writer and director, producer in this town, and who has really talked about someone who's put himself on the line over the years. I was griping about this to him, and a couple of years ago I said, Lionel, here's some money. Go write a script on this subject. And he wrote a script on Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. And I said, because I want to tell the story about race and this. And he wrote a beautiful script, and we're actually out trying to sell the darn thing. But I mean, that's how I get bothered by that issue. And it just troubles me that in the last, coincidentally, the last 3.5 years, I was not an Obama supporter, but I did say, well, at least we can begin to bury this issue now. And we haven't. It is festering now, and I'm not sure how this happened. Well, I have some ideas. I think a lot of it has been done for political expediency. I think a lot of it has been done for, in a way that has been detrimental to this nation as a whole. And it really, really troubles me. I went to a school that was 90% black when I grew up in Chicago, high school. I was the minority kid. So when I hear conservative, Republican, and racist in the same. I get a little annoyed.
Okay. Segment 3, Hollywood. Talked about your views. Help me to understand this place. Couple of statistics. 1992, Bill Clinton is elected to the presidency with 43% of the vote in the country. And a very reputable poll of writers and directors and producers in film and television showed that 83% of them voted for Clinton. 20 years later, what's changed? Not much, apparently. According to the statistics I've got, Barack Obama has outraised Mitt Romney in Hollywood by at least 5-1. So here you have a town which is in business to sell ideas and stories to the rest of the country, but is just fundamentally out of sync in its own thinking and in the stories it tells itself from the rest of the country.
Yeah, I mean,
Why?
I get asked that question a lot. Whenever I'm with a group in any other part of the country, they ask some version of that, and I don't have the definitive answer. I have some answers. It's hard to get inside other people's head. And,
sure.
And there are people who believe what they believe for very strong and personal reasons.
Furthermore, let's stipulate we're talking about people who are your friends.
Yeah.
You enjoy this community. You're not denigrating anyone.
However, there's a rarefied air out here if you've been successful. And you travel in these circles, and you got a home here and a home there, and you're flying here, and you're meeting this guy, and you're doing that, and people are bowing and scraping to you. Given that, and you rely on this America we're talking about to keep you at that level,
right?
So the way I think that what happens inside the head is I'm going to demonstrate what a regular guy I am by supporting the little people, and we know what that means. It means we're voting Democratic because we're liberal and we believe we want everyone to pay their fair share. Now, I may be paying my accountant a lot of money to make sure I'm paying as little as possible. I always tell my friends I say we don't pay enough taxes. I say, you know, the tax rates are just legal minimums. You can write a check, and some people do, by the way. You can write a check to the Treasury tomorrow, and you send all your money to them. And so I say, if you feel we're not carrying out, go ahead, just go ahead. But I'm guessing they're not doing that.
Right.
So I think that's part of it. I think there's I don't want to say guilt is the driving force, but there's a little bit of that. I'm doing so great, and I had humble beginnings, and how can I show? And to me, it's perverse, because the way you show it is to create a situation in the country, help create, foster a situation where anyone can accomplish what you've accomplished. And the way to do that is, we know, the free market way and all that
right.
kind of thing. But their idea is, if I show that I'm willing to, if I stand up for them by defending them against these big, nasty, and then you get into that stereotypical. It's the big the big nasty business-oriented Republicans who don't care about the little guys, and Hollywood likes a story, and that's sort of the story, and that's the script that's been laid out.
Michael Medved, talk show host, friend of mine. You may know him too, as far as I know.
I know of Michael. I don't think we've ever met.
He was a writer in Hollywood for a time.
Sure.
Michael's explanation, quote, in the entertainment industry, you have to have your emotions constantly available to you. So the actor has to cry on cue. The writer is worried about eliciting an emotional reaction. You have to have your emotions constantly available to you. And a town that operates on emotional self-manipulation will lean to the left. We support the Democratic Party because they give more money to poor people and that feels good immediately. Whereas the conservative says, well, where does the money come from? Are you depressing economic growth? The conservative position actually requires three or four steps of thought. Do you buy that?
To some degree, there is.
Extremely smart people.
These
in this
are the
town,
script
right?
writers, and yeah. these are. You know, it's not as interesting a story, just dramatically. You know, as you just described it, you know, where does the money come from? Doesn't make as good a script. Except how do we get this poor bag lady off the street right. and into a shelter? And away because the big business next door isn't helping, we're going to help them. That's a better story. You know, that's right. So it's probably always going to be this way. And I think you're just, you know, I think you're spitting into the wind to try to change it. What is changing, I think, is other than the money, which can help a campaign, I think people are tuning out celebrity endorsements. I mean, everyone has an opinion, especially now in this internet age where everyone's blogging. You don't have to be a celebrity to have your own, to talk to the world. Everybody's doing it. So I'm not sure how much influence they have. I guess on the social side of things, certainly when you can move opinion with a particularly popular movie, I suppose.
Last question. I know you've mentioned your friend Lionel Chetwynd, and I know he's been working, as you said, he's out there. Lionel Chetwynd has spent several decades of his life talking about politics in this town. Do you feel a change? I found a quotation, I was Googling around, film producer called Frank DeMartini, who blogs on a website called Hollywood Republican. Hollywood used to be about 80-20 Democrat over Republican. Now I'd say it's closer to 60-40, close quote. Do you feel a change?
I'm not sure which is right, but it's somewhere in that. It's probably less than 80 now, and it may be a little more than 60. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, nothing terribly dramatic about it. I still think at the sort of big star level that liberalism will prevail because, again, it's if you're a big star, that's how you show that you're not. You may enjoy all your homes, but in truth, you're really aching for people who don't have these.
Right. Okay. George Clooney's not going to get a nice headline in People magazine by saying, "I think I pay too much in taxes."
Right. Right.
Got it.
You know, there's an interesting thing here, and it's generationally, this may finally be changing. We're a very forgiving country. We forgive a tax on our harbors. We're very forgiving. This town will never, as long as a certain generation exists, never get over what has come to be known as the blacklist. That's still a dry. You can say
five decades.
It's incredible. I mean, it's a half a century, more than that, ago. And you better
explain the blacklist. So during the communist, McCarthy, anti-communist period, there was the Hollywood Ten, isn't that what they were called?
Yeah, and
studios refused to deal with them because of their communist associations.
Yeah, and a lot of them had, but then there was also if you name names, you didn't name it.
Right.
Not to unearth that whole thing, whether it was right, whether it was wrong, we all have our opinions on that. And you get into Whittaker Chambers, all that good stuff, but it's still. You say McCarthy, and that's what McCarthyism.
Wow.
Again, generationally, that may finally be starting to change, which may account from 80 to 60.
Got it. Segment four, the sayings of Chairman Pat. As I said, you're not just a committed conservative, you're an articulate conservative. I would like to read a few quotations and have you explicate them.
All right.
This is Pat Sajak on Obamacare, or actually on Frank Rich of the New York Times comment on Obamacare. Quote, New York Times columnist Frank Rich, I'm quoting you, has apparently been able to get to the bottom of the vocal opposition to Obamacare as the ever-tolerant Rich reasons, quote, you're quoting Frank Rich, the conjunction of a black president and a female speaker of the House would sow fears among a dwindling and threatened minority no matter what politics were in play, close quote. Now it's back to quoting you. Would it be too much to approach the matter on its merits and leave the psychobabble to Dr. Phil? Close quote.
Yeah, I don't know where that's first of all, going back to how you feel about America, what a damning thing for Frank Rich to say about his fellow citizens. Are there misogynists out there? Are there racists out there? Absolutely, and there always will be, and what are you going to do? But the idea that white males, you know, especially those the gun-toting, Bible-thumping, are opposed to a piece of legislation because what was it?
Because a black president and a female speaker of the House, and the original, there's also a gay chairman of an important congressional committee, Barney Frank.
I mean, I don't care much for Harry Reid, and he's none of the above. So, you know, I don't know where that stuff comes from. And if it were possible to find a conservative version of that,
you'd smack them around too.
I would smack them around, and they would get smacked around.
Right.
They would be as. I mean, that's.
But this is the impulse from.
But that's hate speech to me. What he does there. I don't get that. I don't get that, and I don't like that.
This is Herblock being unfair to Goldwater, and then some.
Yeah, I mean, it's more than unfair. It's just unspeakably vile to me to make that kind of general statement about your fellow citizens. You want to talk about a particular thing that somebody wrote that reflects that, fine, but to make this blanket statement, I'm not sure how big a blanket it was. But anyway, can you tell I'm troubled by it?
Yes, yes, no. You're an angry white man, Pat. Pat Sajak, quote, "I'm not making an argument to ban pornography, but its omnipresence in this information age certainly makes it worthy of discussion. As for the left, their argument that the government should stay out of the bedroom is one that would be easier to support if only they weren't so anxious to welcome the government into every other room in the House." Close quote.
It's an interesting, the left has an interesting idea about what it wants to keep hands off and what it wants to keep hands on. And that's what that was all about. And that's not an anti-pornography, that's not pro-pornography, that's just, but there is no doubt that it should be an issue. Not do we ban it, not do we go back to being Victorian, but what do we do when any kid can pick up any device and sometimes, whether he wants it or not, search for something and there it is?
It is a valid issue.
It is. It just needs to be discussed. There are just some things that if you even want to discuss, I always think about Tipper Gore, back when her husband was running, trying to get the nomination some cycles ago, she suggested that rock lyrics be printed on them. That's all. Just don't ban them. Just if I'm a parent, okay, here's what my kids, do I like this or not? Well, I mean, it practically derailed Gore's campaign. It's such, you talk about Social Security being the third rail. The left has third rails all over the place. They skip one and two all the time. It's all third rails. And to even discuss them makes you want to tear up the First Amendment, you know, in that case.
This is on Mitt Romney in a piece in Ricochet this past February in the middle of the GOP primary battle. So this is in the context of Romney going up against Gingrich and Rick Perry and Rick Santorum and others. Quote,
this is from me.
This is from you.
Oh,
I'm quoting you.
I'll pay attention then.
For years, John McCain was the left's favorite Republican. But a strange thing happened to Senator McCain when he became his party's nominee for president. According to the Democrats and their media friends, the maverick was suddenly marching in lockstep with the most radical fringe of the right. Pat Sajak, I still haven't made up my mind as to which candidate would be best for the Republican Party, but sometimes I wonder if the person with the R next to his name will always be called a wild-eyed conservative. Should we just go ahead and nominate one?
Well, you do wonder. You know, we do, and there's this battle that goes on within the party about how pure a conservative you are, and then we get in this, well, he's got to be electable, whatever that means, and got to appeal to these. Have you met an uncommitted voter? I don't know who these people are. I don't know anyone who's uncommitted. People pretty much know how they feel. But putting that aside, you wonder sometimes because you could take. Well, McCain to me was a perfect example because he would tweak Bush and the left. Oh, right. Left loved him. Left right. loved him. Right. And then suddenly he became this demon. And to my eyes, he didn't change at all. Just the adjectives changed when they wrote about him.
Last quotation from Chairman Pat here. liberal hysteria. And this is a piece in which you quote Nancy Pelosi saying she's trying to save life on the planet as we know it. And Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, who describes a budget deal as a catastrophe on multiple levels. And then you write, quote, in 1975, Newsweek famously ran a story on the catastrophic impact of global cooling. Of course, now we are warming ourselves into oblivion. I actually don't think the left is dealing in scare tactics with these pronouncements. I believe they mean what they say. And they may be right. Their world may end on November 6th, 2012. Why is the left so hysterical?
I don't know. It's strange. Talk about early on, we talked about the anti-war movement. I do think there's a segment of the pop, maybe it's youth, I don't know what it is, but there's youth, and then there's sort of a permanent protesting class who needs to find the next issue. You know, apartheid was good for a while. We've got climate change now. It's okay, this is, let's find some, where, you know, I don't even know, you know, this monetary stuff they're always writing about. I don't even know what it is. I don't even know what they're writing for or against. I think every now and then you just need a good riot.
All right. Segment 5, fan mail. A few questions came in when I mentioned on Ricochet that I would be.
And I didn't peek.
Didn't you peek?
I did not peek.
Good for you, Pat. Okay. From Aaron Miller.
Had I known Aaron, I would have peeked.
Pat Sajak is a consummate gentleman. Why does being a gentleman matter?
I don't know, and I appreciate the thought, but I try to be. I mean, I try to be in my personal life. I'm just more comfortable that way. I like to be treated nicely, and I try to be on the show. I do think I'm troubled by a lot of. I'm not a television basher. Look, I'm playing hangman and spinning a giant multicolored wheel. I mean, I'm not doing Shakespeare in the Park. But at least we are respectful of our players. If someone screws up, as they do, I try to get them through it and not make it worse for them.
Right.
We're in a strange time in entertainment in general. It's not just that it's crude and crass. It's just mean. It's really mean. And, you know, everyone wants to run to the YouTube video to see, you know, to see the guy, you know, bang his head against the wall after he fell off the bike. I don't know what that is. It's troubling to me on some level. I don't know what we do about it. But, yeah, I like ladies and gentlemen. I mean, I have a crass side, and I use it in selective moments. And once we stop rolling the tape, I'll tell you a couple of jokes.
All right. From Chris, I'm not sure I can pronounce his name correctly. Chris Hurtubise, quote, as Hillsdale College alumni, my wife and I are curious to know how Mr. Sajak came to be on the board. What are his thoughts about the trajectory of our college, Hillsdale, and American higher education in general?
Well, first of all, Hillsdale happened really because of Larry Arne, who you mentioned.
The president of the
college. Yeah, you mentioned Claremont, and I met Larry at a few events and ended up serving on the board of Claremont. Larry then moved on to become president of Hillsdale, and he's my Pied Piper. I visited the campus a few times, and I just love the place. And this idea of not taking federal or state money is not just to make a point. It's really to allow the it's shocking how much time and effort and paperwork is devoted to these rules
compliance
and regulations.
That's
it's crazy. It's just crazy. The administrative colleges are so expensive, and it's all administrative. It's taking care of this stuff. So Hillsdale doesn't have to do that, which does free it up to do, I joked earlier, to teach. But that's the focus there.
Roughly 5,000 colleges and universities in America, 2, Hillsdale and Grove City in Pennsylvania, refuse to take federal money.
Yeah.
How's Hillsdale doing? Well, good financial shape?
Very good. In fact, schools come to Hillsdale and say, how do you do this? Because they're envious of the school's financial shape. And part of the reason is people are attracted to that philosophy. And so we have, I'm one of them, we have a lot of people. I mean, I'm the vice chairman of the board. I didn't go to Hillsdale. None of my family did. And most of the supporters, unlike most schools, rely on
alums, right, sure.
And that web that goes out. The vast majority of people who support Hillsdale have never set foot on campus.
This is a separate show, but the question dealt with American higher education in general. And in some ways, the questions we've been asking about this town apply to the faculty of every fancy school in the country. They're overwhelmingly liberal. Poll after poll, you look at the financial... Do you have any idea why that is?
It's
another mystery.
It is a bit of a mystery, although I think the sort of protesting class of the 60s are kind of running things in academia now. So I think we have a generational chance to change
things. All the right people are about to retire and die.
Yeah, and you know, there's something to be said for death. When it happens at the right time to the right people.
From Dog's Body, what's Pat's favorite Shakespeare play and has he acted in one?
I have never acted in a Shakespeare play, and I don't know that I'm capable of doing it. But I could read Hamlet once a week.
Could you really?
Yeah, well, maybe I'm exaggerating. Okay.
Let me twist the question. What's Pat's favorite Neil Simon play and has he acted in one?
Oddly enough, I have. Actually, we did Odd Couple up at the Connecticut Repertory Theater. Doesn't that sound highfalutin? But that was great fun.
A good review in the New York Times.
Yeah, does that trouble you?
It does. It makes me worry about you, Pat, just a little bit.
Yeah, they were very nice. And I confess that I haven't read it because I've learned to stay away from those things, and I will eventually. But I know it was good because my co-star wasn't sulking, so I heard it was. And I heard from people like you saying, "How come you got a good review in the Times?" So I give them credit to be able to separate. Or they didn't know.
So this leads to a larger question, which is, Pat Sajak, 30 years host of Wheel of Fortune. You're famous. You have nice houses in a couple of places that I know of.
Several watches.
And several watches. And so what's Pat Sajak do next? Serious acting?
No.
Congress?
No. You know what I'm going to speak in that. You know what Pat Sajak's going to do? I've always wanted to do that. He is going to do Wheel for 3 more years or 4 more years or 6 more years or whatever it is. I'm not out to break any records. And then we'll probably...
You've already broken records with Wheel.
It could be. I mean, 60 Minutes has been on longer than we have. So other shows have been on longer. Price is Right, I think, has been on longer. But
not that anybody's counting.
No, exactly. But we've been on a long time. And the show will go long after I'm gone because it's still, in these days of splintered audiences, as you pointed out in your very generous opening, it still has a very big national audience every night. I'm guessing that Wheel will be the last big public thing I do. I mean, I'm not going to sit on the porch necessarily and whittle, but there's other business stuff I'm interested in that I do. And I there's no point moving on anything else. I mean, in a career sense, I mean, what am I going to do? The acting's fun, but I'm not. If I were 45 instead of 65, I would. You know, think more about that. I'm very happy with my lot in life. Look, I didn't intend to be a game show host. It was if I had made a list of the 30 things in show business I thought I'd end up doing, game show host would have been like 28th. Nothing against it. I just didn't think that was my thing. And when Merv Griffin hired me, I said that to him, and he said, because I said, you know, I'm kind of low key and I don't do that. Back then, it was more of the, hey, you want $10,000? I said, I don't do that. He said, no, you don't understand. I like what you do, And to Merv's great credit, he never once said to me, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? He just let me do what I did. So I'm happy with the way it all turned out. I mean, how can you ask for something more than that? So I'll probably just, maybe I will sit on the front porch and whittle.
May I close by discussing my theory of Pat Sajak?
I didn't know. Is this like the unified theory?
Something like that. My theory of Pat Sajak is based on an email I got the other day from our friend, Larry Arn, the president of Hillsdale College. Let me quote Larry. He's talking about you. Everywhere he goes, people interrupt him to get his autograph. His way of coping is in every facet of his life to assert the normal. He raises his children normally. He has a normal marriage. He lives in Maryland mainly, not Hollywood, so as not to be in that pressure cooker, close quote. So here's my theory of Pat Sajak, which gets to your politics, that you're a lot like Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan grew up in the Midwest. He spent his career as a radio announcer and then as an actor, always focusing on ordinary Americans as his audience. Ronald Reagan never lived in New York. He never spent a moment worrying what people thought of him in the faculty lounge at Yale or Harvard. And Ronald Reagan liked leading a normal life because he understood that normal American life is pretty darned good. And I think that's in you as well. Am I onto something?
You had me at you're like Ronald Reagan.
Well,
you don't have to say any more. That's fine. I'll sleep with a smile on my face tonight. I know what you're saying, and I think there's something to that, and I don't know what that is, and I'm not going to bow and take any credit for it. I think it has to do with the people I've come in contact with in my life, in a way you're talking about the struggles, in a way the slow steady march, which I mean the show's been really big, but for a long time things weren't.
It was a decade of really hard work.
Yeah. and so I had time to get used to it along the way and not think too much of myself and realize that I'm lucky to be at this point now. I'm lucky to be at this point. So it wasn't as if I was bagging groceries one day and flying around in private planes the next. But anything that would tie me in any way to President Reagan is
last,
okay with
last
me.
Last question. Watching this show, there's going to be some 18-year-old kid, couple 18-year-old kids in Chicago, let's say, who want to do what you've done. They want to come to this town. They want to make it. One of those kids will make it, and one of those kids won't. What would you say to each one?
Wow. Listen, to the first of all, you only don't make it if you stop trying to make it. So people who don't make it, in a weird way, it's kind of their own doing. And I almost said their own fault. It's not that. You at some point you'd say, I'm going to stop banging my head against the wall and I'm going to try something else. Maybe if you banged one more time, maybe I went to that the station that finally hired me in Nashville. I went there, 18 times. If I stopped
literally,
at 17,
literally,
oh yeah, they would finally come, they would oh it's him again, and they were very nice to me. They'd buy me a sandwich or something and talk. There's nothing here for you, and blah blah blah. So that's part of it, and so I would. I mean, to the ones who make it, we've been a little tough on Hollywood, but. Anyone who makes it in my business, that's the business I know best, I salute, because it's a very difficult business. It's difficult to succeed, and it's difficult to maintain success. So whatever political differences we have, boy, if you've been doing something and you're working in this town, my hat's off to you, because it ain't easy.
Okay. Truly, this is the last question. After beginning with the most important question on the planet, does Vanna White get to keep those clothes she wears? Let me end with the second most important question. Who will be in the World Series this year?
Oh, boy. It's increasingly difficult to tell because of the wild
Rangers cards. Isn't going to be one for sure?
But I'm going to say that the Rangers will be in it for the third year in a row, and the Washington Nationals.
Really?
Well, I don't know for sure.
No, but do you feel that, or are you just...
Yeah, I wanted to get that look from you. No, I think... That's what I'm going to say. And of course, the irony is, as you probably know, is that the second coming of the Washington Senators moved to Texas and became the Rangers.
Oh, that's
so there.
Right.
There will be a certain symmetry there.
It'll be an all Washington game.
It could be, and if you could throw Minnesota in, which was the first Washington team to move, that would, if you could have a three-way, that'd be perfect.
Only Pat Sajak would know that much about who used to be the Washington Senators. Exactly. Pat Sajak, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.